I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What we're learning at graduation time, confirming the Dow Jones ticker, is that the market is back. The meltdown is history. Finance is a bigger sector in our economy and richer than it's ever been before. And it's the next step for 4 out of every 10 Ivy League graduates in the class of 2015. Wall Street salaries starting at $85K. Here is a sample of Harvard ambitions this week.
I'll be working at an economic consulting firm in New York. I think money will be more important when I want to start a family, but right now that's making sure that I can afford a place in New York, which is stressful.
I'll be doing the usual route to New York and then working at a venture capital firm. The lifestyle is way better. At least half of my considerations. It was definitely money.
I'm going to a tech startup that does credit scoring. Have you ever heard of effective altruism? Effective altruism is the idea of using evidence and reason to find the best ways of improving the world.
Fundamentally, I think things like banking and just running deals, those are things that have a lot of very positive long-term effects. You know, things like IPOs, things like mergers really help a lot of people.
I mean, I applied to a couple big corporate jobs, but a lot of those want to see your SAT scores from high school and certain coursework. It's all right. I'm very pleased that I studied the humanities. If I'd gotten an offer for a job that paid very well, I'm sure I would have taken it.
Well, I never was offered the money, so I didn't turn it down. I'm teaching in Baltimore next year. I would teach for America.
I'm working on, it's called low observable RF engineering, basically stealth communication. The consulting probably would have been bigger money, but I'd like to just do things. I don't want to just move numbers around or move money around.
I'm a sociology major, and most of the stuff I do is always on video games. I really like talking about video games.
You're not going to make the games.
No, I'm just going to tell people how to make the games.
This is our graduation reflection on capitalism, which we've been talking about for months. What's more interesting than the numbers here is the thinking underlying it. Our guest, the philosopher Michael Sandel, gives the most popular undergraduate lectures at Harvard about justice and democracy, with a warning to this market-minded generation, A, that there are treasures out there that money cannot buy, and also B, that market thinking can eat like acid into real value. The entrepreneurial investor Semyon Dukach has a very different view. He grew up in the anti-market Soviet Union, and he's thrived in the American free market. We're also enlisting the Pulitzer Prize novelist of Home and Housekeeping, Marilyn Robinson, who says market ideology is actually a pretender, almost a fake in our democratic value system. Also, we'll hear from the historian Julia Ott, who has a take on how and just when a nation of yeoman farmers and producers of real stuff went financial. We're 401k people now in what she calls, with some irony, an investor's democracy. Michael Sandel, you're the keynote communitarian here with a halfway Puritan sermon to lay out. Let's hear it. What's the risk? What's the problem?
Well, I'd like to begin with the students we just heard from.
Please.
I think that there is a complexity. There are layers of complexity within the minds and hearts of the students we just heard from that may not have come through in their account of where they're going to work.
Let's unlayer it.
Well, what strikes me is whether or not students are going to work for hedge funds or consulting firms or for nonprofits, what strikes me is that students, my students, but I find students everywhere around the world, are searching for an opportunity to think about questions of meaning, questions of values. There's a great hunger to figure out what we believe in and why. And this strikes me among students, and it provides an opening for my subject, which is political philosophy.
Can I say, I also hear in those voices a flight from those serious concerns. And all this talk about my New York apartment is covering, I think, a fundamental anxiety, maybe fear, about a very shaky system that they know they're part of.
Well, it could be that, and it could be that we would learn more if we interrogated them a little bit more fully and expansively than we had the opportunity to do just now. But I think this tension that I find among students, young people, between, of course, wanting to succeed in an intensely competitive market society and wanting to find meaning and value and an answer to what is the good life. I think that tension is writ large in our society. I think if you look at the shape of our public discourse, what's striking about it is how empty it is. There is a kind of hollowness in the way we engage in our public debates. And I think this hollowness has been accentuated in the last few decades. And I think it's not unconnected from the fact that during the same time, we've leaned more heavily, not just in politics and economics, but in our culture, on a kind of market triumphalist faith. We've accepted without critical reflection the assumption that markets are the primary instrument for achieving the for achieving the public good. It goes back to the age of Reagan and Thatcher, but it became absorbed as an unquestioned assumption even when they passed from the political scene and were succeeded by left-of-center political parties. And so I think the emptiness in our public discourse reflects the fact that we have not had a meaningful debate in recent decades.
But why not,
about
Michael,
this assumption.
Can the market not stand an honest, open conversation?
Well, I think that this is the great missing debate in our politics. I think the reason we haven't had that debate isn't just that we're enamored with markets because they deliver the goods and rising GDP. I think it's partly that. But I also think that relying on markets to decide contested social and ethical and political questions seems to be a way of avoiding engaging in public with controversial and competing conceptions of the good life. And because we fear the disagreement, the controversy that would result from engaging in that kind of debate, because we worry about the majority coercing or imposing on the minority their values, we reach for what seems to be a neutral way of deciding hard public questions. And markets and market thinking have played that role, I think, mistakenly. And the result is we have a kind of emptiness, a void in public discourse that people everywhere are frustrated about.
I want to say yes and no. Contrariwise, I mean, I think it has been more possible in the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years since the meltdown to say the word capitalism without genuflecting than it ever was before. I mean, and we've done a number of radio conversations about it. Sven Beckert, I think, his history of cotton, a kind of 250-year biography of capitalism with all its destruction, including slavery and its brutality, as well as its prodigious invention and all this sort of thing. But, you know, Michael Lewis, I think the best journalist in America, has written another big book on capitalism and arguing especially that the banks are bigger and more out of control than before. I mean, this is sort of mainstream conversation, but there are others. This open debate now on capitalism and the environment, Naomi Klein says, can't be done. We got to find another way. I mean, make room for those new entries. We didn't hear those arguments about capitalism 20 years ago.
Well, I think you're right that among historians and authors, people are writing books and commentaries and op-ed pieces on capitalism and also on inequality, which we're hearing more about than we did in the years just before the financial crisis. But I think what's striking is that when the financial crisis came, I think many people assumed that this marked the end of an era of market triumphalist faith that had run its course really from roughly 1980 to the financial crisis. And now there would be a public debate about where markets serve the public good and where they don't belong, where they may crowd out non-market values worth caring about. And what's striking to me, notwithstanding some distinguished authors and historians and journalists, including the ones you've mentioned, Chris, if you look at the public discourse, if you look at the presidential debates, debates we have around election time, we have not had that debate. There was some debate about regulatory reform, And there are people who write about inequality. But as for the corrosive effect, the crowding out effect that market values can have in social life generally, that I think is the debate that's missing.
You know, your book, What Money Can't Buy, catalogs so many worrisome symptoms, Michael, but come right to the point here. What's the foreseeable danger of not talking our way, you know, into the culvert?
The real danger is that by degrees, almost without our realizing it, we find ourselves drifting from having a market economy to becoming a market society. The difference is this: a market economy is a tool, a valuable and effective tool for organizing productive activity. But a market society is a place where almost everything is up for sale. It's a way of life in which market thinking and market values reach into almost every sphere of life, from personal relations in family life to health and education and civic life. And this is the real worry. Let me give you a very...
I was just going to say, I have a feeling Bernie Sanders might introduce some of these threads into a presidential debate, and people will welcome it. How else could it be a required part of the presidential conversation?
Well, let me pull back from presidential conversations to a small example that's telling. It used to be, when I was a kid, going to an amusement park, part of the experience was waiting in long lines for popular rides. That's not true today. In many amusement parks now, almost routinely, you can, if you have the money, pay extra and get a ticket that enables you to go to the head of the line. Now, this is a small example. It's not a great moral failing of the Republic, but it's writ small, something that's happening throughout our social life.
When we come back, I want to hear about the problems that could bring the Republic down, including a general lack of confidence in where we're going. Coming up, a made-in-Moscow argument for markets from a Russian-American who felt stifled by the old communism and now liberated by entrepreneurialism. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, kicking the tires of market culture. Semyon Dukach grew up in Soviet Russia. He got to know the color of money as a professional hotshot on the MIT blackjack team. He went on to be an entrepreneur and an angel investor in a Boston firm called Tech Stars. Semyon Dukach, is there a moral case to be made for market capitalism?
Well, I think there is. As a parent of one of these kids that's graduating college right now, I can tell you they're not just looking for meaning. They're looking for doing something. They want to create. They want to build. They want to engage. And I agree with you that the ones that are going off to Wall Street, much in the way that I went off to beat the casinos for some money, may find that kind of direct pursuit of wealth is empty and pointless. But some of these other kids, the ones who want to create something, start a company, build some technology, create something for others, people who are motivated by a desire to help other people because they want to take away some pain or maybe create some joy for others, I think they will find that they'll eventually get to that financial reward through market forces and also find personal fulfillment.
A number of these kids said they'll do Wall Street for 5 years. And then what they want? I wonder. You'd want to follow their stories. What is this business about getting in and then discovering a purpose? I wonder about that.
I think it's sad. I think it is dangerous for them personally to chase the dollar. I think they should do what they want now, and I think they should look internally and think about what they really want and why they want it, and think about, you know, questions like mortality and purpose. So I guess I agree, but. But I think that the market economy, market society, and market forces are ultimately aligned to make the world a better place.
Michael Sandel, please.
Yeah, I agree with the basic thrust of what you're suggesting when you say that, that young people who want to build and create or engage in entrepreneurialism to create a useful good or service for other people. May very well find fulfillment as well as make money. And I don't for a moment, criticize those pursuits or those vocations. I think that's capitalism at its best. But what's striking about the shape of the economy, if you look at the shape of the economy over the past 40 years, there's been a shift from making and producing things and the rewards attached to that with financialization, with speculative activities that don't directly or even very indirectly build or create things. And so I would like to get back to an idea of capitalism that is about building and creating goods and services. That, I think, is very important and can
this
be
satisfied. This was a slide noted in Presidential Politics from George Romney to Mitt Romney. George Romney made wonderful cars. Mitt Romney made some terrific investments.
You can look at companies. Look at GE, which by the 2000s, early 2000s, GE was making more money with their making loans, their financial activities, than they were selling refrigerators. The General Motors was making more money selling car loans than selling and making and selling cars. So I'm in favor of what you're describing. If capitalism is about building and creating and entrepreneurship, that I think would be a healthy corrective to the financialization of the economy and the shift to a kind of moral economy of speculation that we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years.
I think we've always seen speculation. I think speculation is as old as capitalism or older. But I think what you're seeing now is more shift from manufacturing physical goods and basic services to things like software, online services. And
that's fine. That's a good thing.
Property.
But if you actually look at the percentage of GDP that's accounted for by financial activity as against productive activity, producing goods and services, including software, it's gone from about 8 or 10% in the 1960s to close to one-third by the early 2000s. That represents quite a significant shift, and it distorts, I think, the ambitions and aspirations of the young people we heard at the beginning.
Maybe it's
away
only
from the productive aspects of capitalism. That's my worry.
Maybe it's only the young people who are going to produce real stuff. But I want to know, Semyon, because you coach entrepreneurs, how do you steer, how do you make good people out of young capitalists?
I tell them to take the long view. I tell them to think about their reputation. And first and foremost, think before they start a company, before they grow a business, don't think so much about their product or how cool their tech is or whatnot, or certainly don't think about how much money they'll make. Think about who their customers are. Think about why they care. Think about what feelings they have for those people and allow themselves to be driven by empathy, to be driven perhaps even by love. That, I believe, leads to entrepreneurial success.
Can you say that to a young entrepreneur?
I do all the time.
How do you say it?
Well, I say for one thing that I would not have wanting to take myself as a young man, as a mentee. Yeah. I made the mistake of being very short-term focused, and especially growing up poor. You know, I just wanted to make some money any way I could early on. And I found that very quickly to be hollow and not to lead to deep satisfaction. And so I try to encourage them to bypass that step, not do 5 years on Wall Street, go straight to doing something they believe in.
Speak to Michael's anxiety or concern, even in that small sample of Harvard Voices, that these people aren't going out to make things.
Well, I think some of them are and some of them aren't.
No,
but I guess
I agree.
Yeah. I agree that there's a lure of Wall Street and there's a lure of short-sighted, pointless speculation that isn't fulfilling and isn't great for society. But I do think it's also a self-correcting problem to a large extent.
Michael, I was wondering how many of those students that we spoke to at Harvard had taken your course, and how much of your caution just bounces right off these eager, and I felt somewhat propagandized kids.
Yeah, well, it may depend on the question one asks them and the mood and the moment, but I don't find that questions of justice and the good life, which is really what form the subject of political philosophy, I don't find that they bounce off young people. I find that they resonate with young people. And I don't think you can make draw a clear conclusion from the fact that a young person is maybe drawn by the allure of a hedge fund or a consulting firm and conclude necessarily that they're morally vacant or spiritually empty. They may still be searching. There may be competing tensions within their aspirations and their soul. So I see a much more complicated, layered set of aspirations and hopes among these people.
You know, we've been wondering all week whether there is a moment in history when the market-mindedness of today took root, a moment that explains how Thomas Jefferson's nation of yeoman farmers and producers got to be so invested in financial instruments of all kinds. At the New School in New York, Julia Ott is among those young historians restudying capitalism. She pinpoints one key transition.
But the story really begins in World War I. And what happens is that the Wilson administration is very worried that they are unable to demonstrate the consent of the American population towards the war effort, because Wilson was elected on a "he kept us out of war" pledge, and most of Americans can't vote. So how are you going to show the American public's behind the war effort? And this is the question that the Wilson administration tries to answer with the great Liberty Bond and war savings campaigns of World War I. And in these campaigns, Americans really seize upon the ownership of federal debt as a way of demonstrating that they not only support the war, but that they support a democracy, they support the foundational principle of private property rights. And the whole idea is to sort of give everyone a stake in the system. And we know that a crash happened in 1929 in both the housing markets and, of course, most famously in the financial markets. There's too much debt. There's too much lending on these kinds of assets. But what doesn't go away and what stays with us for the rest of the 20th century and up until today are the ideas that property ownership are fundamental to American citizenship, that financial securities markets play a handmaiden to the realization of that goal, whether it's through your 401k plan or whether it's through your house, which you need a mortgage for, right? And then the beliefs that financial markets are efficient and that financial markets are sort of the overarching architecture of the entire economic system in the United States.
Julia, by now it's very personal. I'm thinking of the two editors of a very hot magazine in the 90s, mm-hmm. Fast Company, if you remember, telling me, the rule of the 90s is you think of yourself as a corporation. That means your production, your finance, your planning, your investor relations. You got to do it all. And that's who we are. We're little bits of human capital learning how to exploit ourselves. That's the rule. We're different people in this world.
Mm-hmm. We are living in an era since the 1980s, really, in which work has become short-term, precarious, at will, all up and down the socioeconomic ladder. And if we look from the 1980s, 90s, 2000s till today versus what it would have been like at mid-century, Americans today have to manage as individuals much more of their own risk of unemployment, of sickness, risk of outliving one's savings. All of this kind of stuff is mediated by the financial markets, by your 401k plan, by your medical savings account, by your insurance policies of various sorts. And people don't really get those things through jobs anymore the way they used to either.
That was Julia Ott. Her big book on this subject is When Wall Street Met Main Street, The Quest for an Investor's Democracy. I ask Semyon Dukach and then Michael Sandel, do we have any idea how many people are ruined by this game, this very, very uncertain world we live in, or depressed or scared out of their wits about losing in this game?
I'm not sure I've seen a better game described. I mean, regulation has its place, but other ways of organizing society that don't use monetary value as a way of measuring value to others, they tend to concentrate power in different ways that don't benefit, in my experience, don't benefit people as well.
I'm just struck by the precariousness, as she said, of this system today, Michael. Emotionally, individually.
I think there is deep insecurity, and more risk has been offloaded by companies and by welfare states onto individuals. That's been one of the stories of the last four decades or so. And this has gone with the discrediting of not only government, but of the public realm and of shared civic responsibilities. But I think it's important to distinguish, to ask what finance is for. Finance is not a bad thing, but the social purpose of finance is to allocate capital to socially useful purposes, so that factories can be built and homes can be built and people can be employed. And what's gone wrong with finance and the financial system in recent decades is that many of the financial activities that reap the greatest rewards have very little to do with this fundamental social purpose of finance, to allocate capital to socially useful activities. Much of it has to do with speculation at several times removed from actually allocating capital to build factories or to invest in roads or in hospitals or in schools or in homes. And so it's that abstraction of financial activity and speculation from the real economy and the heaping enormous rewards that has distorted, I think, the moral purpose, really, of capitalism, and also attracted young people, talented young people, lured them away from building and creating the kinds of activities that Semyon is encouraging toward activities that amount essentially to a kind of casino capitalism.
I'm wondering, Semyon, where is the simple place of human happiness, human thriving in this system? And there's a further question about, you know, is our planet survivable under this kind of pressure of market exploitation? But first, I want to hear somebody put human happiness, however you want to define it, you know, first.
Well, monetary reward is a measure of human happiness. It's a measure of human desire for things and services, right? And so optimizing how much money you will make long term should optimize what you will do for others.
But not in a brutal and uneven and we know unequal competition.
Correct. So the competition needs to become more equal and there is a room for regulation. And certainly, the part of the financial system that I'm personally exposed to has to do with directly investing capital in new companies started by mostly young people, okay, some of whom coming right out of school or quitting school.
Right.
And in that case, they believe in what they're going to build,
sure,
and the people who invest in them believe in them, and they want to help them, and they want to give them capital to do what they're going to do. And so that, at least that aspect of the financial system, I'm very comfortable
yes,
with.
Yes, that's a good thing. That's entirely a good thing. But what really gets the eye-catching rewards, for the most part, within finance over in recent decades has not been direct investment of that kind. I mean, that's I think closer to the core of what justifies capitalism. Well,
what's more eye-catching than the rewards of the folks who started Google or Facebook? I mean, some of the wealthiest people on the planet have gotten there by creating companies.
Michael, you're a popular preacher in places, especially India and China, that are still building out their capitalist systems. And a lot of them are uneasy about it. And you speak to that, especially matters of family in China and spiritual values. What says the voice of American experience, that's you, to people who are sort of early in the game, in the process?
Well, the first thing I would say, Chris, is I don't really think of myself, and I hope I don't come across there or anywhere as a preacher, because I really, when I've had an opportunity to travel to a great many places, including China a number of times.
With huge effect.
Insofar as there's an effect, though, it's not from preaching or telling them what to think about capitalism or anything else, but inviting them, challenging them, encouraging them to join in a dialogue with me, with one another, and with philosophers they may read about justice and ethics and the good life, and about what kind of society is worth trying to bring about. And that project of engaging in that kind of discourse in public, reasoning together, arguing together about big ethical questions, that's what draws them.
And how does the argument go differently in form and content and style than it does here?
Well, in an economy, in the case of China, which has just achieved enormous economic growth, having embraced a kind of market capitalism, a state-driven market capitalism. On the one hand, there is enormous faith in GDP as the ultimate measure of value and achievement, and it's been a huge achievement. But at the same time, there's a growing realization that that can't be all there is. There's growing concern about the environment. There's growing concern about the gap between rich and poor, rising inequality in China, but also in many, many places. And so people now, young people, but citizens generally, are in the mood, I think, to step back and to think hard and to argue and reason together about what else there is that's worth aiming at.
I want to know why we Americans are so much easier and happier talking about the spiritual void in China than we are talking about the very same gaps in our own thinking.
I think that's something, a predicament that we share.
We're coming back with the Heartland novelist Marilyn Robinson, who's got a thought that the love of markets in this country, in this culture, is nowhere near the oldest or the favorite among our real core values. Marilyn Robinson next. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source on What Money Can and Cannot Buy with Michael Sandel and Semyon Dukach. And for a taste of traditional Iowa wisdom, beautifully phrased, Marilyn Robinson. She is the decorated and beloved novelist of Gilead and her new one, Lila. I asked her this week about the roots of the soul roots of our marketized thinking.
People have accepted this weird ideologized capitalism, which is not a phrase that ever occurs in our early literature. It took on its ideological character in opposition to communism in the 50s. But what that meant is that we poised ourselves at the mirror image of every mistake that the Soviet Union made, because ideology is a stupid way to proceed in terms of something as incredibly pragmatic in its requirements as economics. You know, the thing that has to be remembered is that the word value has been narrowed in its meaning so that it sort of means profit, something you can put in the bank. Mm. But value historically, value culturally, has always meant the enhancement of people's lives. You know, it has always meant the arts and the sciences and all these things that we have still implicit in the culture, but are turning on because they're anomalous in terms of this novel, mindless ideology that so many people have been persuaded of. I think we should call our system free enterprise, much less restrictive, much less algorithmic. You know, having freed ourselves from that word capitalism, we should look at what we actually value, which includes the incredible richness of humane resources we have created in this country, that we now act as if there's some sort of foreign imposition or something. These spectacular universities and so on that we ought to just be enjoying, you know. This idea that everything is monetizable. You know, the sort of thing where you'd take the little freshman aside and say, not everything is monetizable. We get a hardened definition of what capitalism is from critics who say that it governs every aspect of life. No, it doesn't.
Michael Sandel, Semyon Dukach, we know she speaks the truth. We know that we love even the marathon. We love our landscapes. We love our communities. We know we love our music much more than we love either the idea or the fact of markets, so-called. How do we act on that?
Well, I think it's worth picking up on one observation that we just heard, that markets are purely pragmatic. I think that understates or underappreciates the allure of market thinking and market values and market reasoning. I think part of the allure is that we view markets and a market society not just as a way of generating wealth and productivity. We view markets as embodying freedom. And this runs deep in the American political tradition. And I think it's misleading in an important way. It is a kind of freedom that's embodied in market relations, but it's the freedom of the consumer, freedom of choice in the marketplace. And I think that there's a risk of allowing a consumerist vision of freedom to distract us from an older, more demanding, but ultimately more important dimension of freedom, which is the civic conception of freedom, that we are free ultimately not as consumers in the marketplace. That is pragmatic and instrumental. We're free ultimately, if we're free, as citizens, and that requires cultivating certain habits and dispositions, certain civic virtues, certain orientations to the public good that markets themselves can't provide. Education has to provide that. The media has to provide that. A certain kind of common life has to nurture that orientation to the public good, which is to say civic freedom.
Semyon Dukach, I'm wondering how a Russian ear hears, it's not that sentimental really, but Marilyn Robinson's appeal to the things that we really love. And in the Russian tradition, we think of the land, the language, the church in certain ways, but the history. I mean, how do you hear that?
Oh, my Russian ear was first perked up when you mentioned the nostalgia for the lines you waited in at amusement parks. As a kid, I also remember waiting in a lot of lines.
Yeah.
But the nostalgia hasn't really set in.
Right.
I think...
You like the idea of being able to buy your way to the head of the line?
Absolutely.
You do?
I do. I do like it. I like the idea of people who have amassed more value somehow through ideally have done some good to someone else, waiting less and other people waiting longer.
I don't think
it's perfect, but I think it's... I think solving problems by simply allocating the goods to whoever is willing to wait the longest is even worse.
All right. Could I ask you a question about that? We talked about the amusement park, buying your way to the head of the line. On Capitol Hill, you can do this. If you want to listen to, they had a Supreme Court argument recently in the same-sex marriage case. Everyone wanted to go and sit in the hearing. There are a certain number of seats set aside, first come, first serve, to listen to a U.S. Supreme Court argument. The line began forming on Friday for a hearing. The doors opened on Tuesday. There's a company in Washington, a line-standing company. If you don't want to stand in the line, you can go and pay them, and they will hire a homeless person to stand in the line for you for as long as it takes. People worked out that at the rate of pay for this line-standing company to get a seat in the U.S. Supreme Court for that hearing, $6,000. What about in that case?
Well, in that case, I think it shows the futility of allocating space to that venue by lines in the first place. They ought to simply charge for it with an auction in the first place. Absolutely, because then, through technology, you could create a system where people who really ought to be there will have resources allocated towards funding their presence. That at least would be a possibility.
So even for the Supreme Court, or even as they also do it, to sit in Congress, to listen to a congressional hearing, you think rather than have the line-standing companies, Congress or the court, should auction off the seats to the highest bidder?
I really do. And my assumption would be that the highest bidder would actually ultimately, in a well-regulated society, go to the people who need that the most.
Who need it the most or who can best afford it?
Perhaps it'll be someone for whom it'll be donated because it makes sense for them to be there. Let's say there's a lobby of people who are interested in a particular cause, and they would sponsor a representative of that cause to be present.
You know, this reminds me of Dan Ariely's studies and questionnaires about the allocation of Final Four basketball tickets. We can think up ways to do those things, and it's actually kind of fun to invent them. But it's not the stuff that's going to bring the world to a halt in either way. I want to hear from you, Michael, where the crunch comes in all these smaller crises. There's a billionaire hedge fund manager named Paul Tudor Jones, and he got a lot of attention a few months ago for saying out loud that we're staring down really serious stuff, specifically revolution, taxes or war at the emerging levels of inequality in this country. And he says when 10% of the people own 90% of the stocks and high corporate profits help only a few, the game, even in the near term, is unsustainable.
Well, let me give you then some big examples.
Please.
Rather than micro examples of how market thinking infiltrates everyday life. It's a familiar story that after Citizens United, especially, although we don't allow an outright market in votes, the system of campaign finance that we have comes pretty close to enabling money to buy a political voice. That's one. A second, the way we fight our wars. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there were more private military contractors on the ground than there were U.S. military troops.
That's a shocker.
Now, this is not because we had a public debate about whether we wanted to outsource war to private companies, but somehow this is what has happened over recent decades. So there's a second. Here's a third. Against the background of rising inequality, putting a price on more and more aspects of the good life enables those of us who can afford it to buy our way out of public spaces and civic places. Over time, as this happens, the affluent segregate themselves, buy their way out of public transportation, public health facilities, recreational centers. And pretty soon we find that those who are affluent and those who are of modest means live and work and shop and play in different places. We send our children to different schools. And so ultimately what's corrupted by the rampant marketization of social and civic life, what's corrupted, what's crowded out, is the commonality that makes for a shared democratic citizenship. Democracy doesn't require perfect equality, but it does require that people from different social backgrounds and classes, from different walks of life, encounter one another, bump up against one another in the course of everyday life, because this is how we learn to negotiate and abide our differences, and this is how we come to care for the common good. So here are three ways, Chris. You've been pressing me. Here are three big things. Electoral democracy, the way we fight our wars and who fights them, and the terms of the common life that we live or don't live in public places and common spaces. These are three big, important ways in which our civic life is undermined by putting a price on everything.
Michael, that we can get used to even this. We can get used to a political election coming up in 2016 that is already appalling. It is disgusting. It is offensive. It's tough even to think about it. Not the dynastic piece alone, but the money, the saturation in money. The Koch brothers raising $1 billion to tip that election. And yet we won't notice it really until they cancel the election. It just got too stinky. I wonder if, Sammy, you notice this as an enthusiastic newcomer, a feeling of, I don't know, not terminal decline, but an emergency.
I don't. It's still
outsourcing a war to private contractors.
The country feels pretty democratic to me. I don't know. From what I've seen in the rest of the world, it's not perfect, for sure. But democracy doesn't require equality or any measure of equality. Democracy requires a reasonable measure of an equality of opportunity. And I think if you look at the bulk of the wealthiest people in the country today started out poor, or at least poor by some degree. So I don't see that crisis now.
But a political system, a political game as we've known it, requires candidates to talk, as Hillary Clinton does not, to reporters, to discuss the day's agenda. It requires a belief that this thing will be settled by debate, not by advertising, not by commercials.
I think money plays an important role in politics, of course, but it doesn't totally buy elections in America. I mean, I think when people are fed up with something enough, no matter how much funding goes behind it, they're going to vote those ideas or those people out of office. So I think perhaps I agree it would be great if Hillary Clinton spoke to reporters more, and maybe she will and maybe she won't. But maybe people don't care enough. And at some point, if it gets bad enough, people will care.
Where would you start the debate, Michael, on a privatized war in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Outsourced war. I would start the debate right there and ask, how should we decide? I would try to encourage a serious public debate about how we should decide who fights our wars and to what extent should that, the answer to that question, be governed by market thinking and market values, and in ways that reflect the background inequalities of our society. What we miss, and this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, Chris, is what makes our public discourse so empty and hollow is we are not very good at reasoning together and arguing together about big ethical questions, about questions to do with how to value goods, whether it's a contribution to one's society as a citizen, whether it's our role as parents, whether it's the way we should value nature if we're debating the environment. And we try to outsource moral judgments to markets as if markets were neutral mechanisms for deciding public questions. They're not neutral. Outsourcing our moral judgments and our civic debates to market thinking and market values, I think, is a disservice that economics, as it's taught these days, including to some extent in my own university, encourages. Economics presents itself as if it were a value-neutral science of human behavior and social choice. My argument is this is a mistake. Economics should be taught as if it was understood by the classical economists, going back to Adam Smith.
Does it help to call it
as a moral science?
Does it help to clarify that it is an ideology, too? It's a very narrow...
Well, it rests on certain normative assumptions. And it's for us as democratic citizens to debate those normative assumptions directly, not to take them for granted, not to take them as given, not to conceive economics as a value-neutral science, and not to conceive markets as an alternative to democratic public discourse.
Michael, we're well aware that you're a very big deal in China nowadays. We got to find ways to bring that public citizen, loved and followed by thousands, probably millions and millions abroad, into some basic conversations here too.
There are some striking similarities. One of them is that not only in China and the United States, but in many societies around the world, especially those that have embraced markets, we struggle with inequality. We struggle with the corrosive effects of market thinking on other values, social and civic values. But what I find in every place I travel is a hunger for a public life of larger meaning that engages more directly than we're accustomed to do these days with big ethical questions.
Thank you, Michael Sandel. Thank you, Semyon Dukach. Thanks also to Julia Ott and Marilyn Robinson. You can find a longer cut of Julia Ott and Marilyn Robinson on our website, along with a podcast conversation with the book critic James Wood. That's radioopensource.org. We're going out on Romance Without Finance by Charlie Parker and Tiny Grimes. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomino. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
Romance without finance is a nuisance.
Oh, but it is.
Oh, baby, I must have me some gold. Romance without finance just don't make sense.
No kind of way.
Oh, baby, mama, give up that gold. You so great and you so fine. You ain't got no money, you can't be mine. It ain't no joke to be stone broke. Baby, you know I ain't lying when I say romance without finance is a nuisance.
It's a drag.